Cases 21-1569 and 21-2674, Eaton Corporation and Subsidiaries v. Commissioner of Internal Revenue. Oral arguments not to exceed 20 minutes per side. Ms. Judith Ann Hagley for the appellant cross-appellee.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Judith Hagley from the Department of Justice. I'm representing the Commissioner of Internal Revenue in this case, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
Thank you. The primary issue in this case is whether the IRS abused its discretion in canceling the advance pricing agreements, which the parties refer to as APAs, that it entered into with Eaton. And the IRS did not abuse its discretion because the revenue procedures that the parties agreed governed these agreements permit cancellation for the errors.
Is that the way to frame it as an abuse of discretion? I mean, it's just a contract, right? So you canceled it, so you were the plaintiff below, or you would bear the burden of showing there's a breach and then that you could cancel it under ordinary contract principles, right?
Under ordinary contract principles, that's how contracts work. But this is a binding agreement, but counsel for Eaton concedes on page 35 of its brief that the evaluation is for abuse of discretion, and it's because the APA is entered into the IRS's authority under Section 42.
So the parties agree that contract principles don't apply?
The parties agreed that the revenue procedures govern the interpretation, implementation, administration of the revenue procedure, of the APAs, not general contract principles. And that's agreed to in the APAs on page 425 and 445 of the record in this case. The reliance on general contract principles that Eaton presses in this case is for the proposition that the commissioner bears the burden of proof in this case rather than Eaton. That's wrong, but it's also irrelevant. It's wrong for the reason that this is a deficiency proceeding. In a deficiency proceeding, the taxpayer bears the burden of proof, but it's irrelevant because even if the commissioner bore the burden, it's identified the grounds for cancellation in this case and has demonstrated that it's relevant, I mean, that it's satisfied under the undisputed facts. First and foremost, the revenue procedures permit cancellation for a mistake of material fact in an APA report. And Eaton's APA reports contain three material representations that are invalid and constitute mistakes of material fact. One, the APA reports represented that the tax returns reported the APA transfer price, that the Eaton's transfer pricing allocated the agreed amount of profit to U.S. taxation by satisfying the Berry ratio, and that Eaton's transfer pricing required no compensating adjustments. And it's undisputed that each of those representations is false, that Eaton's tax returns, in fact, grossly inflated the transfer pricing as set out in our chart on page 15 of our opening brief. For the years 2005 through 2008 alone, the pricing was inflated by $165 million as compared to what was represented in the APA reports.
Does it matter that there...
Well, so let me ask you, how would you define a material fact within the context of the APA, And the reason I'm asking is because you just mentioned the figure of $165 million. Mm-hmm. But would any computational error or any data that was erroneous, regardless of size, constitute a material fact if you deem it a misrepresentation? Or does it have some bearing or some relationship to the amount?
A couple responses to that, Your Honor. Number one, the repeated failings in the APA reports are not just data errors. These are also verification errors. And that's the key point. And this is something that Eaton and the tax court glossed over, that they ignored the importance of the APA reports, which is to verify what was happening on the tax returns. Now, the tax returns had the data and computation errors. And data and computation errors are themselves grounds for cancellation under governing APA procedures. And you asked about what's a material fact. Well, the revenue procedures help provide a definition of what material facts are. And they are those facts that include the knowledge of which would significantly result in a significantly different APA or no APA at all, or APA reports with materially different allocation of income. And that is what we have here. If the IRS had known about Eaton's actual transfer pricing, there would have been a materially different allocation of income in the form of compensating adjustments.
That materiality definition for the reports is in one of the revenue procedures, not in the other one, correct?
That is correct. But the parties have proceeded with the understanding that the revenue procedures are essentially the same. But taking that point, and that would apply.
So I would agree that the annual report definition in the second one would apply to the first one as well.
I don't think they've said that it makes a difference in this case. But even looking at the language of material fact.
I think it's extremely significant because one of the revenue procedures has a specific materiality definition for annual report. One of them doesn't. The one that doesn't seems to have the traditional kind of materiality definition that would have said, hey, would you have entered into this agreement if you had known? Kind of an inducement-based materiality. The annual report materiality in the second revenue procedure seems to really be, hey, if there's just a mistake that's a big enough mistake, that's material. I mean, that your case would be much stronger under that definition than the other one, isn't it?
Well, taking that point, and for that applies to the 2006 year, looking at the 2005 year, which is governed by Revenue Procedure 9653, which defines, as you point out, material fact as a fact that if known would have resulted in a significantly different APA or no APA at all, we have that here with the Berry ratio representation. And the Berry ratio, you know, to emphasize again, is a critical part of the APA transfer pricing methodology because it determines the amount of profit that is allocated to the U.S. taxation. And we know from the parties negotiating history that the commissioner would not have entered into an APA that had the Berry ratios that were reported, that were reflected in the tax returns for 2005.
Is that a mistake? My understanding is that they made a mistake in how they did it, but not at the front end in terms of what the ratio was going to be or what the ratio was that they were going to follow.
But that is a mistake of what the actual Berry ratio was and whether it satisfied the transfer pricing.
Right, but there's a difference, you agree, between me saying, hey, I'm going to do this, and then we enter into an agreement, and then later on I don't do it. So it's a mistake. But it's not. You would have to establish that I knew at the time that I did, or that I did, even if there were something like a promissory fraud theory, that I didn't intend on doing it, or I just intended to not carry out the agreement. I mean, otherwise, you have an action for breach of contract for deficiency, but not to rescind the entire agreement, right?
Well, I think that if you. And this gets back to the point I was trying to make before, that it's not just the data error on the tax return. It is this subsequent error of the failure of verification in the APA report. The tax return was what the tax return was, and it didn't have the correct transfer pricing, and it didn't have numbers that satisfied the Berry ratio. But the tax return is filed in September, and the APA report is filed 3 months later, and the purpose of the APA report, and this is why it's critical, is to actually force the taxpayer to go back and verify, are the numbers on the tax return correct? And the taxpayer evidently did not do that, and in addition, represented in the APA report that the numbers, in fact, satisfied the Berry ratio. And it's that verification failure, the mistake there, that demonstrates that the IRS would not have entered into these agreements if it had known that Eaton either could not or would not verify that it was satisfying the Berry ratio.
You're saying that if I had known that you weren't going to carry out a duty under the contract, I wouldn't have entered into the contract.
Well, as material fact is
but
defined.
Is that what you're saying? You're saying they're supposed to verify, and they didn't do it. And if we had known at the time that we entered into the contract that they weren't going to verify it, we wouldn't have entered into the contract.
Well, that is accurate. That's a mistake of fact. By signing these APAs.
But that's like thousands of years of common law. I mean, everybody would say the same thing. Like, if I had known you were going to breach the contract, I wouldn't have entered into the contract. We don't do that for inducement, right? We say, hey, you breached the contract. I'm suing you for breach, not rescission.
But these are not ordinary contracts. They're not governed by ordinary contract law. They are, by their express terms, governed by the revenue procedures.
I understand that, but what I suggest is that the materiality definition in the revenue procedures looks to me like the way you would look at an inducement like materiality requirement under breach of under contract law.
Except for the way that it's written is it's not looking at the point in time that the parties entered into the contract. It also, a mistake of fact, includes factual mistakes that arise in the future. And a couple of things indicate this. One, there's the reference to mistakes of fact in subsequent reports. And that's what we have here. Whatever the parties thought when they entered into the agreement, they were provided, Eaton provided the government APA reports that contained mistakes of material fact, mistakes regarding the Berry ratio of an amount that the IRS would never have entered into, and mistakes for the 2006 report under the 2004 revenue procedure that would have resulted in a significantly different allocation of income. You know, we know from the cancellation provision in the revenue procedures that the cancellation dates back to when the mistake occurred. And if, as you suggested, it would always be at the very beginning, that cancellation provision doesn't make sense. So again, it's the revenue procedures that dictate how cancellation works here, not just general concepts of contract law. In addition,
so counsel, let me ask you against the backdrop of case law that referred to by Judge Nalbandian, mm-hmm. What's the best case that supports your position? Today,
what is
your best case?
Well, this is a case of first impression. So our best case that supports an interpretation of the cancellation provisions of an APA, this is that case. What we're relying on is the language of the agreements that the parties entered into. And under those agreements, they expressly state, again, page 425 and 445 of the appendix, that it's the revenue procedures that govern the interpretation, administration, and implementation of the APAs. And there's
isn't it odd though that with all of the history of IRS and entering into these agreements that this is the first time that a court has had an opportunity to examine and opine on this issue or rule on this issue?
I don't think it's odd. I think it shows that the IRS doesn't willy-nilly cancel agreements. I mean, the IRS has entered into over 2,000 of the APAs, and in the 30-year history of the APA program, has only canceled 11, including this one. You know, this is the case.
I don't know if this is relevant or not, but isn't this a case of self-reporting by the taxpayer of the error?
No, it's. I mean,
the IRS caught the mistake itself without the taxpayer bringing it to their attention.
It's not known what the IRS could or couldn't have. The IRS, what we do know is the IRS had been auditing, when the corrections were made, the IRS had been auditing Eaton since 2007. But I will say this, you know, looking at it as corrections, the revenue procedures expressly permit cancellation for corrected errors. Right.
But I'm wondering whether the materiality question might pertain to that, in that the taxpayer here apparently did a way of calculating that they thought was going to work, but it wasn't implemented correctly. An employee or employees of the taxpayer discover it, they bring it to the IRS's attention, and I think they're fixing the problem, and then you cancel the agreement. That seems kind of odd if a taxpayer didn't intentionally make the error. Are you saying there was an intentional?
No, we're not. We're actually saying two points to that. Number one, that intent has nothing to do with materiality. Intent goes to other grounds for cancellation.
Well, does it go to the penalties at least?
There are penalties, two points there. Number one, it's well settled under the regulations, and this is Regulation 1.662-6A, and we cite this in our reply, that once a taxpayer is under audit, penalties and other transfer pricing analysis is based on the original return, not on amended returns. Mm. But you get to the point, you raise a good point about how they were using a different methodology to calculate the prices on the tax return. This is another grounds for cancellation because you can cancel for omissions of material fact, and they never disclosed to the APA program that they were going to be using the APA multiplier in that separate type of methodology of calculating a transfer price rather than the agreed upon APA transfer pricing methodology set out in the APA agreements. And that's a separate ground that we've discussed that would support cancellation. I'd like to briefly address penalties.
But are you saying that the APA report didn't just have an error with regard to the multiplier, but there was actual a transfer price error that the transfer price methodology, whatever was agreed to in the agreement, that was erroneous? There was a mistake about that in the reports?
In the reports describe the transfer pricing methodology, and if you look at the report, the transfer pricing methodology calculation appears perfect. It's creating the Berry ratio. What we're saying is because of their verification failure, that is not what they actually did on their tax returns. On their tax returns, they used a separate calculation using the APA multiplier and focusing on...
I understand that they didn't... maybe I don't understand, but my understanding is that they internally... when they were trying to translate the transfer price methodology to their own internal accounting, which in turn led to the tax returns, there was a mistake, and that's resulted in the problems with the tax returns. But we're talking about what we're looking for, something material on the face of the reports, right? On the APA reports?
Correct.
What on the face of the APA reports was false or a mistake?
On the face of the APA reports, the APA reports are representing what's in the tax return. And it's representing three things that were not true. One, that the tax return reported the APA transfer price that was set out in the APA report. Two, that the transfer pricing on the tax returns...
Okay, so that one, so what you're saying is in the APA report, they say, hey, IRS, our tax return is accurate because it reflects the transfer price methodology, and it turns out it wasn't accurate. But I mean, yeah, it wasn't accurate. So if they were saying it wasn't accurate, if they were saying it was accurate, I mean, are you saying it was a fraud?
No, I'm not. I'm saying that they weren't following through with what they agreed to do, which is to provide actual verification in the APA reports. They're evidently not going back and checking, this is what our APA report says, and these are the numbers on our tax return. I mean, they made the APA reports, which are a critical part of this program, essentially worthless. Thank you.
Thank you, Council.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Shai Dvoretsky with Skadden Arps on behalf of Eaton. APAs are carefully negotiated agreements about a transfer pricing method. Their purpose is to agree on a method for allocating costs. And if something happens after the agreement that undermines that method, like the underlying economics have changed, then cancellation may be an available remedy. But data and computational errors in implementing the agreed method sometimes happen. And the remedy for that under the revenue procedures is correction, not cancellation. Here, the IRS is trying to use Eaton's self-reported, self-corrected data and computational errors as a way to throw out the entire method that the parties agreed to and to impose additional taxes of 10 times Eaton's errors, 20 times if you count penalties and interests. The revenue procedures that are incorporated into the APAs don't allow that. To start with the question that Judge Nalbandian began Ms. Hagley's argument with, whether contract principles apply. Contract principles apply because the APAs are agreements between the IRS and taxpayers. They incorporate the terms of the revenue procedures as contractual terms. And so as a result of that, the IRS can't cancel the agreement any more than a private contracting party could cancel an agreement. Outside of...
Okay, well, counsel, let me ask you this. The counsel for the IRS said that a part of that contract was a continuous, I guess, review and verification of the data and information that was being provided to the service, and she argues that Eaton did not uphold that requirement, and hence this $165 million correction. What is your response to that portion of her argument?
Judge Donald, if I could take you to the revenue procedures, because the revenue procedures distinguish between what the IRS examines for in, for example, 10.03 of the 2004 revenue procedures, and what the IRS can cancel for, which is in 10.06 of the 2004 revenue procedures. So you can, under 10.03, the IRS can examine for the correctness of the supporting data and computations used to apply the TPM. So, of course, the IRS can examine for that, and then the remedy for that under 10.03.3 is to enforce the APA. Under 10.06, there's no reference there to data and computational errors. So when the IRS was drafting this contract, these revenue procedures, and if there's any ambiguity about it, it should be construed against the IRS as the drafter. When the IRS was drafting these revenue procedures, it knew how to use the term data and computational errors. It didn't carry that over from 10.03 to 10.06. It did, by the way, carry other terms over from 10.03 to 10.06.
So the 2004 revenue procedure is the one that has the separate materiality definition for annual report, right?
Yes. Well, it has an additional sentence that the 1996...
Okay, but it seems to me a fairly significant sentence because it says they'll consider facts material if, for example, knowledge of those facts would have resulted in a materially different allocation of income deductions and credits reported in the annual report. Why isn't a data or computation error something that could have resulted in a materially different allocation of income deductions or credits? I mean, that seems like a fairly broad statement that would encompass a simple mistake of computation.
Judge Nalbandia, let me make 2 points in response to that because I think this is an important question. One, I think that additional sentence in regard to annual reports has to be understood in light of the sentence that precedes it, which is the same concept that existed in the 96 RevProx. And that preceding sentence is that the IRS will consider facts as material if knowledge of the facts would reasonably have resulted in an APA with significantly different terms and conditions. That's the operative standard from 96 as well. And that's what establishes that as an overarching principle, what's material is what goes to the method that is agreed to in the APA, because that's the core purpose of the APA. This second sentence, in regard to annual reports, is just an illustration of how that overarching principle, which is common through both RevProcs, applies in the context of annual reports. So when we're talking about materially different allocations, what we're really talking about is something that would have led to a different TPM. Second point that I want to make on this, taking that additional sentence by its terms, it says a materially different allocation of income deductions or credits than reported in the annual report. And so going back to some of the colloquy between the court and Judge Hagley earlier, the issue that the IRS has is not with what was reported in the annual report. It's with what was carried over through a data and computational error from the annual report into the tax return. That is a question of implementation, not a question of the method. And even by the terms of this sentence, again, we're not talking about a materially different allocation than what's reported in the annual report. What's reported in the annual report is not being challenged here. What's being challenged is what was reported in the tax return. And that implementation, the taking the numbers from the APA report and moving them into the tax return, that is a data and computational error, which is dealt with under 10.03, not under 10.06. On the contract principles point, just to close the loop on that.
Let me ask you this though, I'm confused. So you're saying the sentence preceding that sentence is the kind of the overarching materiality concept, whatever. Here, so I guess I'm just confused. I mean, that language, they added, somebody added this sentence to this revenue procedure that wasn't there before. And it seems to me natural to say, well, they're trying to do something. I mean, with regard to annual reports, materiality, that the original definition of materiality wasn't capturing everything they wanted to capture, that there were problems or whatever it was, that, and they needed to make it clear that for an annual report, we've got this something else. And I guess I'm not sure why that would just be limited to something that would go to the TPM itself, as opposed to just some other error that was in the annual report that could be viewed as, you know, or would have led to some different allocation.
So again, 2 points. One, we're not talking about any error. Even if this was meant to expand the scope of materiality, which I don't think it was, so let me get back to that. But even if it was meant to expand the scope of what's material, all it is talking about is a materially different allocation of income than reported in the annual report. By its terms, that sentence just doesn't apply here because the IRS isn't challenging what was reported in the annual report. It's challenging the translation of that into the return. But to get back to your overarching question about what the IRS was trying to do here, I don't know what the IRS was trying to do here. We've scoured and looked for commentary, for history on this. We don't know what the IRS was trying to do. But I think the best reading of this is that it was simply trying to give an illustration of how the overarching materiality standard applies in a particular context, rather than completely upending the entire purpose of an APA with this one sentence. The purpose of an APA, again, and you can see this, for example, from Section 2.04 of the APAs, the purpose is to agree on a method. Obviously, the IRS then wants that method to be properly applied, which is why it can examine for data and computational errors and, consistent with ordinary contract law, enforce the APA if there was an error in the data and computational errors. But this additional sentence was not meant to blow up the basic contract law principles that the parties have agreed on a method, and if there is an issue with the implementation on that, then they can enforce, they can seek to get the right numbers in, but they can't rescind the entire contract just based on that kind of an error in implementation.
But what kind of annual report error would be the kind of error that would allow you to rescind the contract? I mean, because at that point, I go back to my points about you're not talking about things that you would or wouldn't have necessarily known at the time of contracting, are you? You're making mistakes. You're making such egregious mistakes in the carrying out of the contract that it would have justified rescission.
So let me give you an example. When the parties enter into the APA, they are making certain assumptions about the taxpayer's business, right? This is an economic model for how to allocate costs between Eaton US and the island plants, and there are certain assumptions about what that relationship looks like. One of the things that the APA requires Eaton to do is to update the IRS about any changes in the business that might undermine the whole model for allocating income between the US and the islands. If, for example, Eaton had updated the IRS incorrectly about the business, there had been some significant change in the business, and Eaton improperly represented something to the IRS about that in an annual report, that might be a ground for cancellation, because that error or misrepresentation, whatever it is, would actually go to the very model that the parties agreed to, rather than to the application of the model in practice. And so there can be things that happen after entering into the EPA, there can be things that happen after entry into the APA that could undermine the model and be a grounds for cancellation. But if it's simply a question of applying the model, which is all that's at issue here, then that is a ground for enforcement rather than cancellation. We know that as a matter of just basic contract law. The difference between when you rescind a contract and when you enforce a contract. We know that because, again, of the terms of 10.03 and 10.06 and the use of data and computational errors in 10.03 as a ground for examination, but not as a ground for cancellation in 10.06. Ms. Hagley argues that the failure to verify the numbers is somehow a separate basis for cancellation from the data and computational errors themselves. That can't be right, because any data and computational error is also a failure of verification by definition. If you've made the data and computational error and you filed the return with that error, then in a sense you have failed to verify, because if you had verified properly, you wouldn't have had the error. So that argument just collapses two different categories in the APA. It collapses data and computational errors, which are, again, under 10.03, a separate ground for enforcement, into the actual grounds for cancellation in 10.06. Just to underscore why it is that under 10.03, data and computational errors are not a ground for cancellation. 10.03 is an examination provision. It is not giving the IRS additional grounds to cancel beyond 10.06 in the way that the IRS argues in its brief and that Ms. Hagley argued earlier. We know that, to give you a different example from 10.03 that I think proves that point. 10.03 allows the IRS to examine for compliance with the APA's terms and conditions. 10.06 allows the IRS to cancel for a lack of good faith compliance with the APA's terms and conditions. Under the IRS's view, if 10.03 is creating independent grounds for cancellation, then any noncompliance with the APA's terms and conditions, whether in good faith or whether in bad faith, would be a grounds for cancellation. And then the 10.06 provision about good faith cancellation is meaningless. So we can't read 10.03 as a basis for cancellation. 10.03 is just a basis for examination. And 10.03 talks about examining for data and computational errors, not about canceling for them.
Well, 10.03 contemplates that cancellation could result, right?
It contemplates that.
I mean, it mentions cancellation. I mean, I take it your argument is if cancellation is otherwise appropriate under 10.06 and the examination leads to whatever that is, then you can do it, right?
I think that's the only way to read it, and that's why when it says cancellation, it has that parenthetical that says see 10.06. So it's saying cancellation if the requirements of 10.06 are satisfied, or revision for 10.05, or revocation for 10.07. It's cross-referencing the requirements of those other sections. It's not overriding them. Otherwise, those other sections would be completely meaningless. And so, the core purpose of the APAs here was to come up with a method. The IRS isn't taking issue with the way in which Eaton applied that method in the annual reports. It's taking issue with the way in which that method was then implemented into the tax returns. The other argument that the IRS makes is that the APA multiplier somehow had to be disclosed. The APA multiplier is simply a way to adjust Eaton's financial records to make them reflect the transfer price in the APA. So what happens is Eaton calculates the transfer price using the APA, but then it needs to implement that in its books and records, because Eaton's books and records are maintained on a cost basis, and then those cost basis line items have to be brought up to the level of the transfer price that was agreed to and that's reported in the APA. That's where the implementation error occurred, but that is a data and computational error that again is a ground for correction rather than cancellation. Briefly with...
Yes, I think you're going to probably go to this next, but let me ask you, assume that we find that the commission didn't forfeit its argument for penalties under Section 662, does the 30% penalty, would the 40% penalty still apply? And this is just hypothetical.
To make sure I understand the question, our argument is that the IRS, first of all, asserted penalties too late. It needed to assert them adjustment by adjustment, and it didn't do that. And it also didn't get the necessary supervisory approval. The tax court didn't consider any of those arguments. So we would ask you to affirm on those grounds in the first instance, or to remand.
I do understand your argument. I'm just asking you to make an assumption, as difficult as it may be, and asking you what result under that assumption. And I understand that it's painful for you. entertain that.
Well,
so
that I can minimize my pain, I just want to make sure what I'm assuming. Am I assuming that you are disagreeing with me both on the adjustment by adjustment point and on the supervisory approval point? Because if you disagree with me on both of those points, I think they're separate arguments. If you disagree with me on both of those points, then you would reverse the penalties ruling. But we have distinct arguments that the tax court didn't consider in the first instance that it ought to have the opportunity to consider in the first instance.
Thank you.
And then lastly, on 9932, which is the subject of our cross appeal, I think the parties agree that Eaton should receive 9932 relief, and that should be the basis for a remand to the tax court. In my oral argument form, I had saved 3 minutes for rebuttal on the cross appeal, but I'm happy to answer any questions that the court has now. Otherwise, I'll reserve that time.
You may reserve the time.
Thank you.
Thank you. A couple quick points on cancellation. Number one, the APA, the point of the APA is not just to come up with a transfer pricing method. It's also to make sure that Eaton applies that method on its tax return. And that is the function of the APA reports. And that function cannot be ignored the way that Eaton, you know, appears to ignore it, because they serve a critical function. They purport to make transparent what is otherwise obscured on the tax return. Eaton's tax returns are thousands of pages long. They're complex. And the transfer price is buried in a larger cost figure. The APA reports, which come out a couple of months after the return, are designed to give Eaton a chance to go back and just double check and verify and makes those representations. So APAs provide certainty to both parties. They let Eaton know what transfer pricing method the IRS is going to be applying.
What mistake was it on the APA report that went to the transfer pricing methodology?
What
mistake did they make that you would have looked at and said, oh, their tax returns are bad or whatever because this methodology is not the methodology we agreed to?
Well, 2 points. First, the APA reports represented something that was not true.
Right. And I understand that argument, and believe me, I get it, but I don't... they said they were correct, but they turned out not to be correct. Okay, that's... how critical is that?
It's quite critical, Your Honor, because the IRS...
I assume that when the taxpayer files their tax return, they're implicitly or explicitly representing that they're correct. I mean, you already have them saying, here's my tax return, I'm signing it, hopefully it's correct, and then 3 months later I'm supposed to say, by the way, my tax return is correct. That's the critical point?
The critical point is that when the IRS enters into an APA agreement, it cuts back on its broad discretion that it has under 42. And it does under the understanding that the taxpayer is going to provide APA reports that it can rely on. They're going to clarify what was going on in return, and if it wasn't correct, go back and fix it. And if the IRS doesn't get that, then it's not getting the benefit of its bargain. And here, you know, the years 2001 to 2004, almost the entire life of APA 1, the IRS can't correct that. The statute has run, so the deficiencies, including penalties that are due for those years, are gone because the IRS was relying, as it should have done, on APA reports, but they were incorrect. And that's why it's critical, and that's why it's a material fact that supports cancellation when the statements in the APA reports are materially incorrect, as they are in this case. And with regard to the revenue procedures, in short, we just asked the court to vacate the tax court's decision and remand for the court to consider the transfer pricing method of the commissioner, alternatively to compute penalties. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't believe she raised anything on the cross appeal, did she?
No, I don't think
there's a need for a rebuttal then. The case will be taken under submission.